Good talk.
No,
yeah,
yeah, it's perfect.
Yeah.
It's perfect.
Okay.
So the shiur tonight is dedicated by Atara in memory of Yehoshua Falak ben Moshe Yosef, her grandfather, Simcha Edel Yenta Bas Yehuda Benyamin, your grandmother, and Moshe Yosef ben Yehoshua Falak, which is your uncle. So everyone is encouraged to take some refreshments, and their neshama should have an aliyah. Those were amazing, amazing stories.
Thank
you. So we're going to address a question that I actually never thought too much about, but it happened to be that over the last week, three people independently asked me this question. So initially I just gave them answers that weren't particularly thought out, but I figured if so many people are asking this question, something worth thinking about a little more. So I'm going to share with you my thoughts. And the question is, in last week's parsha as well as this week's parsha, we find references to the hardening of Paro's heart. And there are two phrases used in the Torah to describe this. One is that Hashem was mechazek es libo, and one is lahakshos es libo. So, for example, the pasuk says kaved leiv Paro, his heart is literally heavy. Right, ki ani we read at the beginning of this week's parsha, bo el Paro, ki ani echbadeti es libo ves leiv avadav, leman shisios osayei lebekir bo, so I've made his heart very heavy. And then we have the psukim, vani akshas leiv Paro, I'm gonna harden Paro's heart, harden and make heavy. So one question, which we're not going to talk about tonight, the Chizkuni, I think, might address this, is why each word is used when it's used. But what I want to consider with you is a more basic question, which is, what do each of these two terms mean, and is there a difference between them? It would be inconceivable to say that, well, these are synonyms, and, you know, it's like you learn in writing class. You don't want to use the same phrase, the same word too frequently in close proximity. So I remember whenever I was writing for a particular teacher who was really bothered by that rule. So you wrote a word and then you'd want to use the same word again in the next sentence, but you couldn't. So you just use the thesaurus tool on Word and randomly pick another word, regardless of whether you knew what it meant or not, just so you don't use the same word twice. So clearly that's not the case. Clearly, though they're similar in meaning, there is a difference between them. And so we want to figure out what is the difference and what does each one really mean. So here's some makoros to pass around. So let's start with the phrase to harden Paro's heart. Funny. Actually, I guess there's three. There's l'haksho seslev paro, like v'ani aksha slev paro. There's to be mechazek slev paro, like v'chizakti slev paro. And then there's hichbadati eslibo, right? Kaved. So what's the difference between all three, right? So we have the term kasha, kaved, and chazak. So what do each of these terms mean? All of them seem to refer to the hardening of Paro's heart in some way. I guess akshes leiv Paro is literally, we say, harden the heart. And in a sense, that is the easiest one for us to translate. To harden the heart is presumably the inability to choose. Now, we'll see if that's so simple. But what about the chizakti aslev paro? What does that mean? Literally, the chizakti aslev paro means what? L'chazek, chazak, to give him strength, to strengthen his heart. Now, why would strengthening his heart be relevant here? What does it mean to strengthen Paro's heart? He had weak heart, you know, heart disease, and he strengthened the heart. So, the Sforno, as well as the Ramban, give a very fascinating answer. The answer they give is the following. They're actually addressing the question of how can Hashem take away Paro's free will. After all, we know free will is a very basic tenet of human existence. And there are a number of answers to this question, but one answer that the... they're really good. So one answer that the... that the Sforno and the Ramban suggest is the following. It's actually a very interesting thing. Paro really did not want to let the Jews go. Now that's quite clear, because after all, for the first five plagues, even before Hashem supernaturally intervened, he refused to let the Jews go. He was warned again and again and again, and he absolutely refused. So if that's the case, what changed? Was it that Paro all of a sudden wanted to do what's right, and then Hashem had to harden his heart or strengthen his heart and prevent him from doing so? So the answer is no, of course not. Paro did not want to do what's right. Actually, quite the reverse. Really, what he wanted to do is keep the Jews as his slaves. But he felt pressure. Imagine that I tell you to, or your friend, you know, when I was a little kid, we used to play this game, you know, where I would go to my friend and say, say uncle, and he would say no, and then, you know, twist his arm, twist, until, it depends who is stronger or not. I was usually the guy's arm who was being twisted, actually. But anyway, so my arm was twisted and twisted and twisted until I couldn't hold back any longer, and I say uncle. So is that statement a statement made freely? So in one sense, yes. Theoretically, I could have remained quiet, but the truth is, it was coerced. It wasn't really a free act. So what was happening here was the following. Paro wanted to keep the Jews as his slaves, but the pain and the pressure from the Makos was getting to be too much to bear, and he was going to relent, but not because it was the right thing to do, rather because of the pressure. And therefore, the pasuk is very meduyak. What does the pasuk say? V'chizakti a slave Paro. I'm going to give his heart strength. I'm going to actually give him the wherewithal, the strength, to do what he really wants to do, to not feel that pain of the makos. Take a look at the way the Sforno puts it. It's on the top left column where it's underlined. V'hine amar hakel yizbarach v'ani akshes slave Paro. She is ametz lizbol hamakos. V'lo yishlach miyiras hamakos es Yisrael. He was about to release the Jews due to the fear of the makos. Now it's interesting, he's using this to explain the phrase v'ani akshes slave Paro, but I think it's even more meduyuk to explain the phrase v'chizakti a slave Paro. I'm going to give him the strength. I'm going to give him the strength to do what he really wants to do. In other words, ironically, it's the exact opposite. Our question was, how could Hashem take away his free will? And in a sense, it's Hashem giving him free will. Likewise, the Ramban writes, this is part of a number of things Ramban says in the top right, Rach libo v'haya nimlach l'shalchan mikovet amakos. His heart became soft, and he was going to relent and free them due to the pressure of the plagues. Lo lasos ritzon boro, not to do what's right, namely ratzon Hashem. V'az hiksha Hashem es rucho, v'imetz es levavo l'mansa per shemo. Again, there's a number of things going on in that Ramban where perhaps we could come back to them, but that's the idea, perhaps, of the Lashon of the Chizakti slave Paro, to give strength to Paro's heart. Strength meaning to say, giving him the ability to do what he really wanted to do. Okay, so what does the phrase of Koved Hamakos mean? Meaning to say, Kaved Lev Paro, the heavy of the heart, right? What's the meaning of that? Kaved Lev Paro. So, there's a fascinating medrash that I saw on this topic. The medrash appears in Shmos Rabbah, but it's even more explicit in the Medrash Lakach Tov. So we'll read that version, which is in the left column, the second source. Kaved Lev Paro, Kilomar. Libo Shel Paro, nefach lekaved. Paro's heart had turned into a kaved. What's a kaved? Anyone know?
A liver. Oh.
Okay. So this is like a really bad disease if your heart turns into your liver. I don't know if this is the pshuto shel mikra, but it's picking up on this unusual word, kaved. Kishem shakaved ein bo bina lehavin. Just like the liver doesn't have understanding, discernment, bina, in order to understand ulhaskil, kach ein bina belibo. There was no bina, there was no wisdom, discernment, understanding in the heart of Paro, lehavin ulhaskil. Al kein nichbad libo v'nischazeklo. Therefore, Hashem hardened his heart, nichbad libo v'nischazeklo. Meaning to say, on the one hand, it's saying that Paro didn't take advantage of the gift of free will. He refused to use it. After all, as we noted in the earlier plagues, Paro certainly did have freedom, and he still refused to allow the Jews to go. He hardened his own heart. He refused to accept what was patently true. Instead, he refuses to allow the Jewish people to leave. He sees clear evidence for the existence of God, and yet he refuses. But it's telling us something even more fascinating, which is the mashal being used here is for two organs in the human body, the heart and the liver. What is the symbolism of these two organs? So the truth is, we find in many, many Sfarim the following idea, and we're going to try to explain it. The idea are that there are often three organs that are used to describe human faculties or emotions. The head, the heart, and the liver. The head refers to the rational mind and the human being's rational cognitive ability. The heart is the seat of the emotion. The head, the brain, is the seat of the intellect. The heart is the seat of emotion. And the liver, the kaved, is the seat of the bodily functions. This idea is in many Rishonim, and it's actually interesting. We're going to talk about this in a moment. First of all, it does seem to come from Greek sources, which is interesting. That's the Greek understanding of the body. And I'd like to think about the significance of that. But it's also something that someone who's studied science in the 21st century, the 20th century, is going to be very troubled by. The fact is that the heart doesn't seem to be much more than a pump that pumps blood, and the liver, something that filters blood. What do we mean when we say the heart is the seat of emotion, for example? So the Greeks thought that. The Rishonim seem to have assumed that. But what does that mean for us? So that's the second question we're going to address. But first, let's go back to the basics. So first of all, there's a very fascinating essay that I saw on this topic from Drashos Beis Yishai, written by Rav Fisher. It's Drasha or Simon Mem Zayin. And he begins by noting that there are three types of creatures in the universe that Hashem created in the universe. Number one are angels. Number two, humans. And number three, animals. Only the middle one, only humans, have free will. Animals don't have free will because they lack the, some sources in Chazal say they lack a Yetzer Hara, they lack the intellect, they lack any basis for meaningful free will. Ramban in Parshas Noach notes that they make certain decisions. They certainly have instinct, They might decide whether or not to graze over here or graze over there. But there's no meaningful free will in the sense of understanding what's right and what's wrong and having the ability to do what's right even if that's not natural, to overcome temptation or instinct. Animals obviously lack bechira. Angels also lack bechira, but for the opposite reason. Angels are entirely spiritual beings. They're incorporeal. They have no physical side to them whatsoever. The Rambam stresses that in Hilchos Yisodei HaTorah. The Rambam actually writes that is why they have no bechira. There is a debate, perhaps among the Rishonim, whether it's possible for an angel to take on physical form. The Ramban thinks yes, as in the story of Esav, Sar wrestling Yaakov, or the Malachim visiting Avram Avinu, and the Rambam says no. But fundamentally, they have no physical body, they have no free will. They have no free will because of their elevated status. It's the opposite of animals, right? If animals have no free will because they're entirely physical, so malachim have no free will because they're entirely spiritual. It's an interesting discussion. There are certain mamarim and chazal that talk about angels sinning and even fallen angels and the like. There's an interesting discussion in Rabbeinu Bachya about it, but that's not our focus tonight. For the most part, it's more or less taken for granted that angels have no freedom because they are entirely spiritual or intellectual, sikhli, and animals have no freedom because they are entirely corporeal, entirely physical. And it's humans that have both of these elements that have free will. We are both physical creatures and spiritual creatures. As Rashi notes, Adam was created last because he is both from the Elyonim and the Tachtonim. We are a guf and a neshama. And that explains the tension we naturally experience in life, because we are both guf and neshama. And that's really an awesome combination. The Torah explains that the lashon that we say at the end of Asher Yatzar, Rofecho Basar Umaflila Asos. So that means that Hashem cures every creature. Umaflila Asos. He does something extraordinary. Incredible. What's extraordinary? What's incredible? What is this pasuk or this bracha referring to? The fact that you could have a creature that is comprised both of the physical and the spiritual, two things that seemingly should not be able to coexist, and yet they do coexist within the human being. And it's from that combination that our freedom emerges, our ability to both do what's right and elevate ourselves beyond our instincts and physical desires, and also to sink and do what's wrong and do only what makes us happy, or physical pleasures or emotional pleasures or the like. The Gemara notes the remarkable aspect of this combination by asking the question as follows. It says that after a person dies, so death is essentially the separation of the guf and the neshama. The body and the soul separate. The soul continues to exist in a spiritual, non-physical form. The body is buried and generally decomposes. And Hashem brings the person to judgment. And the soul says, well, you can't hold me accountable because, look, ever since I've separated from the body, I've been floating around. I haven't done anything wrong. And the body says, you can't hold me accountable because I haven't done anything wrong either since the soul left me. I've been buried 6 feet under. So the Gemara gives a mashal. The mashal is that a wealthy individual goes ahead and he has an orchard and he asks a blind and lame person to watch them. He comes back and all the apples are missing. He says to the blind person, "Why'd you take my apples?" The blind person says, "It couldn't be me. I can't see anything." He asks the lame person, "Why'd you take my apples?" He says, "It couldn't be me. I can't walk around. I can't pick them." So he puts the lame person on the shoulders of the blind person and he judges them as a unit. Same thing here. It's the combination of the body and the soul. But it's very interesting because we could ask, what is really the source of our freedom? What is really the source of that free will? Because after all, who's the me, right? Sometimes I say, for example, in the morning, Elokai neshama shenasata bi tahorahi. So, thank you, Hashem, for returning my neshama to me. So apparently, my neshama isn't me. Well, are we the... So what are we? So we said before, there are these three levels, right? The head, the heart, and the liver. These correspond to the three levels of neshama, at least the ones that we could relate to, the three living forces within us, nefesh, ruach, and neshama. There's two other aspects, which chai and yechida are very elevated and sort of beyond our ability to connect to, at least most of us. But the nefesh, ruach, and neshama are these three things. The nefesh is the nefesh habahamis, the physical aspect to us, like we said, what we share with animals, reflected by the kaved. The neshama is what we share with malachim, the sichli aspect of us. And then there's the ruach, which is connected to the lev. The gross is something fascinating, which is, who are we? Really, we are our ruach. And we can tap into and be affected by our nefesh habahamis or our neshama. The seichel has the ability to control the lev. But it's not automatic. In a sense, that is where our freedom lies. It's a very fascinating idea from the Gra. That's the ikar chiyos of a person. But anyway, these are the three aspects of ourselves. The nefesh, ruach, and neshama, the seichel, or the moach, the lev, and the kaved, and the like. So what's this medrash telling us? What this medrash is telling us is the following. The medrash is telling us that Paro's lev turned into his kaved, which means to say that he basically turned into an animal. Because what makes us human, like we just said, is our lev. And the idea is that Paro's freedom was removed, he became like an animal. He only had that kaved, he no longer had a lev. Right? Like the Medrash says, his lev was transformed into a kaved. Kaved lev paro, kilomar, libo shel paro, nefach kaved. The Shmos Rabba says it in a similar way. Kaved lev paro, libo shel paro, nasa kaved. Doesn't just mean heavy. The point is that Paro didn't utilize the gift of freedom, which is rooted in our lev, as we've explained. He didn't act like a human. Paro was warned so many times. The evidence was clear. Any reasonable person would have surely acknowledged that God exists and that God was asking him to release his people, and yet he doesn't. He refuses to acknowledge what was patently clear. And so accordingly, his heart became a liver. The truth is, you could understand this both supernaturally and naturally. You could understand it supernaturally, as the Rambam does, a punishment for his lack of exercising freedom is the loss of freedom. Or you could also understand it more naturally, as the Meiri does, namely that a person can become so entrenched in their own ways and their own mode of thought that they lose their ability to consider anything else. They become so habituated that they live a life of habitualism such that they're no longer living freely. They're no longer thinking. They're simply continuing in their trajectory and following their instincts. But one way or the other, what has happened is, like the Medrash says, libo shel paro nase kaved, right? That's what it means, kaved lev paro. His lev has become a kaved. He doesn't have a lev. So there's a different connotation then, vayechazek Hashem es libo. Vayechazek Hashem es libo refers to the notion of Hashem giving him, almost in a sense the opposite, but really the same as well. They come back to the same point, but they're different elements. Gives him the strength to do what he really wants. And kaved lev paro is that his lev, again, either naturally or supernaturally, has become a kaved. He's become an animal. He no longer is expressing the freedom rooted in the lev. So, before we go on, there is more to say about this that's worth considering. I'd like to address the question that we alluded to before, both the question of how is it that these three mashalim of the nefesh, of the head, the heart, and the liver come from Chachma Yevanis, and B, you know, what do they mean for us, as I said, in the modern world, where we know that the heart is a pump and the liver is a filter? Well, what does that mean? So take a look. We'll start with actually the last page, where the print is small. This is from footnote number 4 of that article that I mentioned to you from Drashos Beis Yishai. And he addresses this point in a fascinating way. And I think it's something that actually relates to a lot of the types of questions that people have regarding Torah and science. Rabim Tmehim Bezeh. Last page. How interesting.
Yeah.
Here you go. Here's this one.
Thank you.
Okay. Rabim Tmehim Bezeh. Many people are astounded about this. Ki lefi ma sheyadu ha'idna, according to that which is known at present, ein ha'lev, ela masheva be'alma, the heart is but a pump, v'ilu ha'regesh mishkano b'moach, kimo ha'seichel, and the heart of the motion is also in the brain, just like the seichel. So, you know, one is the frontal cortex, and well, I don't even know these things, right? But the point is that there's no emotions in the heart. Don't tell all the little girls who, you know, draw those hearts all over the place. Umeidach kisa, and moreover, tmeim rabim al shebechol hamikra kulo v'gam berov rubam shel divrei razal miuchasim hachachma v'abina el halev v'lo al hamoach. Most of the sources in Psukim and Chazal refer to Chachma and Bina as being in the lev. In other words, they don't even refer to the intellect, like we said, as being in the head. They refer to it also as being in the heart. Chutz mishnei makomos begemar, two exceptions. Disahasam, kimeduma li she'en lo moch bekadkodo. Right? There's one, it's repeated twice, but one place, this is the only one I thought of as well, we say, that guy has no, you know, if you want to call someone an idiot, he has no brain in his skull, right? So that does seem to assume that the seed of thought is in your head. But generally speaking, learn in Sefer Mishlei or the like, it actually, both in Chazal and in Tanakh, we always refer to the place of thought as in the heart. That's one. And number two, la'aker mochacha. So, how do we understand that? So, again, two questions. Number one is we know that the heart is just a pump. Number two is, why is it that in Tanakh and in Chazal, we always see the seat of the intellect as being the heart, whereas again, in the Rishonim, we find that the seat of the intellect is the head, the heart is the seat of emotion. V'nei HaKushya Achrona, the second question, Tshuvas HaPshuta Al Pi HaIkra HaGadol Sheshrishu Lanu HaKadmonim Shedibra Torah Kalashim Bnei Adam. The answer is very simple, which is that the Torah speaks in human language. What does that mean? So, that idea of Dibra Torah Kalashim Bnei Adam, Chazal understand it, or primarily use it in one way. The more famous way that we're all aware of that the Rishonim use it is with respect to anthropomorphisms. The way Chazal use it is certain types of phrases, let's say, double lashonos or the like. So according to certain opinions in the Gemara, we don't make diukim from those phraseologies because dibra Torah kalashon ne'adam. In Chazal, in Rishonim, as we said, it refers to anthropomorphisms. There are many, many places where the Torah refers to God using human terms, human characteristics, and those are not to be understood literally. It speaks of God in human terms. And this is important. It helps us understand God, concretize his existence, relate to him. It's very hard to think about and relate to God since we can't see him or feel him or touch him or hear him. None of the physical attributes and even emotional attributes are relevant. But the answer is that for that reason, the Torah sometimes speaks of God in human terms. But he's telling us something even more fascinating, which is that it's not just that the Torah speaks in human terms, kilashon b'nei Adam, but it's the lashon b'nei Adam of the people being addressed. V'hakavanahi lo so lashon shedibru bo b'nei Adam ve'oso hador. The language that was used by people in that generation, shebo nemru advarim, that the things were being said. So what does that mean? That means that in the times of Chazal, people thought of the heart as the seat of the intellect. So therefore, the Torah refers to the heart as the seat of the intellect. In medieval times, when people understood that the head was the seat of the intellect and the heart was the seat of emotion, so then those languages are used. And Avalakushya Rishonu b'mkomo lattis. What about the first question, that the heart is just a pump? Ukiyotei bo tmeim rabim al kach shechachmas ha-kabbalah miyusedes al tmunas ha-olam v'chukei ha-tava shelefi chachmei yavan. It's very interesting. Everybody knows that the cosmology used by the Rambam is the Greek cosmology. He describes the spheres and the rotations of the spheres, and in describing Hashem, uses those terms. Now, the truth of the matter is that this doesn't bother me very much, because he was using the science of his time, and the points that he makes are almost always equally relevant, though he would use different terms. Just to give one simple example, some examples are harder, but a simple example, Rambam describes how Avram Avinu discovered God. So it talks about how Avram Avinu asked himself, how could the spheres rotate without there being a rotator? That's in the beginning of Hilchos Avodah Zarah. So the basic argument is true equally for us. We could all ask ourselves, how could anything exist if there wasn't a creator. Something must have started it all. Something must be the cause of all existence, especially once you acknowledge that there was a beginning, call it the Big Bang or whatever you wish. Things weren't always like this. So what started it all? What could account for the existence of matter? So we all intuitively know that we can take the ideas of the Rambam and, again, very frequently use our own perspective on the universe and understand that he was coming from a world in which science and philosophy was dominated by the Greek perspective. But what perhaps is much more troubling is that many of the Rishonim that were, and even after the Rishonim, but for the most, for the Rishonim and those that followed them, the Chachmei Kabbalah also use this terminology. Now, why is that so much more troubling? Because the Rambam tells us what his source is. What's his source? His Seichel, or Aristotle. Where did he get his science from? So, if the Rambam tells us he got it from Aristotle, so great. So we know where it comes from, and the fact that it's been largely disproven doesn't really bother us, because the Rambam was explaining theological ideas using the science of his time. But where do Mikubalim get their information from? They get their information from Giluyim, Mesora and Giluyim. Kabbalah can't just be made up. Now, there's a bigger topic. There is a concept of Chidushim even in the world of Kabbalah, but for the most part, Kabbalah has to be Kabbalah, received tradition. It comes from Giluyim, revelations, Shemar Yochai had revelations, the Rizal had revelations, the Ramchal had revelations. So it comes from Giluyim, it comes from Mesora. So why is it that they are using these terms from the Greek conception of the universe? They come from Hashem. There shouldn't be errors. Shechachmas HaKabbalah miyusedes al tmunas olam v'chukei ha'teva shelefi chachmas ha'yavan. Much of Chachmas Kabbalah is based on a conception of the world that is rooted in Chachmei Yavan, which again, even is true as they reject, so frequently, fiercely reject Chachma Yavanis. It's the antipathy and the antithesis of Torah, and yet it has that funny Greek conception of the universe. It doesn't seem to make any sense. What are some examples? Galgalim, these concentric spheres. Shiva Kochvei Leches, the seven planets. I guess now it's not such a problem because we're back to seven planets again besides the Earth. But, you know, when I was growing up, there were eight. So that concept of the Shiva Kochvei Leches, that's Greek. Arba Yisodos, you see this in so many Sifrei Kabbalah. Right? You learn Tanya. Talks all about the four elements, earth, water, wind, and fire. Everything is made up of that and is a composite of different forms and of these basic elements, these four elements. Where is that from? It's Greek. Chomer v'tzura, the terms that you see in so many Sifrei Kabbalah, matter and form. Now again, they don't always use these terms like the Greeks did, but still the idea, matter and form, chomer and tzura, comes from them. The connection between something and its root, this type of metaphysical connection, certain type of Platonic viewing of the world. Again, not Plato per se, and the theory of forms and the like, but and many other examples. The low ode, not only that, Elashiva kol chvei lechas remuzim gam b'mikra. There's a pasuk in Zechariah, Shiva Eile, that's the Shiva Neros, right? We read this in Haftarah on Chanukah. Enei Hashem Hema, Mishotetim b'chol aretz, are the eyes of God looking at the earth, which is a reference to the Shiva kol chvei lechas. So how do we understand that? Very, very troubling question. Uliyashiv zeh, Nakdim mashakasav bidrush leparsha shlach. Sheba agada, ein noega klal shel lo bashamayim. First of all, he says, an idea I developed elsewhere is that the principle of lo bashamayim hi is only true with respect to halacha. What's the idea of lo bashamayim hi? The idea is that Hashem told us the Torah once at Sinai through Moshe, and subsequently we don't have any legitimate source of Torah other than what was given once. If a Navi comes and tries to teach us the halacha al pi nevuah, we would know he's a Navi sheker. That concept is not true with respect to Agada. El adaraba anu motzim shehayu mizgalim sodos al yidei kedishe el yonim lemishazacha lekach. We find many great people discovering things in the non-halachic world through Giluyim. V'hine, Harama Menor Nevuchim, Kasav, Be'inyan Mare Maisa Merkava Shel Yechezgel, Kibolo Hamare, Lefi Hadea, Sheyesh Legalgalim Kolos. This is a little beyond us, but we know that there are two places in the Torah that are referred to as Maisim Merkava. These are descriptions of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, esoteric wisdom, one in Yeshayahu, one in Yechezkel. And in the vision in Yechezkel, there are sounds that are coming from the wheels of God's chariots. And the Rambam ascribes that to the ancient view that spheres, these celestial beings and bodies, made noise. And this was a position that was held by wise people in the ancient world, but was disproven by Aristotle, and is wrong. Now, the Rambam doesn't tell you this explicitly, but if you put one and one together, what the Rambam is saying is basically that Yechezkel got the science wrong. And the Rambam has no problem with that. But we have a problem with that, because you could say that Yechezkel wasn't a good scientist, that's totally fine. But Yechezkel was a Navi, and his description of the Maisa Merkava was a description that was prophetic. So how could you have a prophetic description that is built upon scientific errors? Because God knows the science. Vishakocha, Vinoga, Heim Lamalam and Hashemesh, again, other cosmological errors that Yechezkel makes. Afal Pishemesh, Ishein Lagalgalim Kolos, Vishakocha, Vinoga, Heim Lamatam and Hashemesh. What's the solution to that? Why is Rambam okay with scientific errors in Yechezkel's dream? Ki hanevua tavolo lenavi, Lefitmunas ha'olam shebelibo. Prophecy will come to the prophet according to the perspective of the universe that he already has. Meaning to say, in the ancient world, at the time of Yechezkel, the Rambam writes, the assumption was that Galgalim make kolos, whatever that means. And naturally then, when Yechezkel had a vision of God, it came to him in a way in which he perceived God based off of the scientific understanding of the universe that he had. It doesn't mean that God made scientific errors, but it does mean that a Navi would see things based off of and perceive things based off of scientific understandings that were true at the time. This might relate to, though it's not necessarily to say this psukim that imply that the earth is at the center of the universe. Whether or not such psukim exist is a different question, but if you did think they existed, this would explain that as well. Psukim and Nach, at the very least. Whether this is true with respect to Torah is a different question, because the nature of Nevuas Moshe is totally different than the Nevuah of all subsequent Nevi'im, but at least with respect to the Nevuah of subsequent Nevi'im. So, that is the case. If I had a Nevuah nowadays, and some type of perception of Hashem in the universe and in the cosmos, I would see it using the cosmos of contemporary science. And it might be that in another 100 years, that perspective in the universe will be totally changed. Now, does that mean that the Nevi'im were getting false information? And the answer is no, of course not. Because what's important is the message. And the scientific information is the levush. It's a mashal. Let's go back to the example we started with. What's important is to understand these three human capacities: the intellectual capacity, the emotional capacity, and the physical capacity, the physicality within us. The element within the human being that he shares with animals, the animalistic side of the person, the element of the human being that he shares with angels, the heart, right? Just like nowadays, even in Lashon B'nai Adam today, we still refer to the heart that way. We still talk about the heart as the seat of emotion, even though we all know scientifically that the heart is just a pump. It's just a large blood vessel and muscle. But it's helpful. The idea that we need to understand is the idea that there are these three capacities in the human being. There's this nefesh, the ruach, and the neshama. And using the mashal of the head, the heart, and the liver is helpful, especially because the head is high, the highest capacity, what's most ki'ilu, bashamayim, and shared with the angels. The liver is what's lowest. It's associated with digestion, a very corporeal and material and physical side of us. And in the middle, we have the heart. These mashalim are so important. So it's not problematic that Nevi'im, or that you even see a transformation, that for Chazal, for the most part, they saw even the intellect as residing in the heart, and the Rishonim, based off of the Greek scientific influence, changed that. All that's fine. And the same thing going back to all the questions we ask from the Chachmei HaKabbalah or the like. Using these terms, whether it's the elements, the four elements or the like, all these things are levush, they're metaphors, they're helpful metaphors. The metaphors are, of course, rooted in the perspective of the universe that the person using the metaphor had. And even if the ultimate source of that chachma is rooted in Hashem, but Hashem communicates to the individual in language he could understand, Dibra Torah Kalashon Bnei Adam. So it doesn't mean that these giluyim are false just because they use terms that are antiquated. We could use our own terms. If you want to talk about the nefesh abahamis and being in the cerebral cortex and the nefesh, the rash, I don't know where they are, and use them all, good, because they're hate. It doesn't change the message. Let's read on. Uke'en hadvarim ha'ela, kasav harama b'tar sa'ola. So first he's shown that the Rambam holds of this idea in referring to the scientific errors in Yechezkel's prophecy Likewise, the Rama in Tarsa Ola, a sefer that's not usually studied. Rav Fisher is one of the most well-read people you'll ever meet. Brilliant. Bevir inyan aspaklaria she'ena me'ira. That's what the term aspaklaria she'ena me'ira means. Same place where we were before. In other words, that's the term used to describe the difference between the nevuah of Moshe and the nevuah of Shar Nevi'im. V'im amru kach al nevuas Nevi'im, kavachomer minachon adavar la'amro al giluyim shamaymiyim she'ena medregas nevuah. So if we could say that about nevuah, as the Raman, the Rambam say, so certainly we could say them about post-prophetic giluyim, the types of revelations that the Chachmei HaKabbalah had. Vayin b'sefer Magid Meisharm le-Beis Yosef, that's the Beis Yosef sefer, which records his conversations that he had in a dream with his Magid. Parshnas Savim v'zel Shono, this is what it says over there. Afal pisha lefamim ani mefari shum perush al pasuk she'eno kein. Halo lefimai de'ihu bir'uscha ani omer. V'hainu dechsev achen ruachi be'enosh. Kolomar, lefum mai de'is bir'usa de'barnash, hachi machzian lei. I make things appear understood in the way that you see, not in a way that's objectively true. Hashem has a plan in terms of when he reveals wisdom to the world. And different kufos have a proliferation of different types of wisdom. There was a proliferation of a certain type of wisdom in the Greek era. And there are many different ones in art, in music, in technology, and the like. And there's a plan to it. Why Hashem opened up the gates of scientific wisdom in the last several centuries, we don't know. It's part of the plan and the development of the creation, bringing it towards its ultimate end. Obviously, if Hashem would have referred to the world in ways that we understand now to people living 2,500 years ago, so they would have no idea what it means. But that's the idea. He continues talking about this in actually halachic term, in halachic sense. We're not going to read it together, but it relates to an interesting halachic discussion whereby the Gemara says you could kill certain types of lice on Shabbos because they spontaneously generate, and whether that would apply nowadays. When we know lice don't spontaneously generate, do we say that since, according to the naked eye, they do, in the sense that their eggs are microscopic, they can't be seen or not? And obviously the halachic realm is different from the hashgafic realm, but he discusses this along those lines in his continuation. But that's, I guess, what we have time to discuss tonight. So, very fascinating explanation of these terms that you see in so many svarim. Again, what we focused on tonight was the three aspects of the three human faculties, the head, the heart, and the liver, the nefesh, ruach, and neshama. They correspond to the three parts of the Mishkan. Many other threes correspond to this. And the idea of why it is that we'll find so many of the Rishonim, not just the rationalist Rishonim, but also the mystical Rishonim, using these Greek terms, and that it's important to understand that that doesn't in any way take away from the legitimacy of their message or the truth of their message. It does, though, mean that sometimes you have to translate that into terms that you could relate to. But when you understand that these are really mashalim for deeper truths, then these questions don't bother you at all. So once again, the neshama should have an aliyah, and have a good night.
Yeah.